Legal Matters.
And I'm joined now on the line by Advocate Sean Mayer, who joins me now on the line. Advocate, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate your time.
Good evening, Morby. Thank you very much for your time as well.
So let me understand. Minors who need representation in matters legal are not necessarily going to be represented by their parents, Advocate?
It's normally it would be because the parents are the guardians of the children, and the guardianship they get through the Children's Act as one of their responsibilities and rights. So the responsibility and rights are set out in the Children's Act as care, contact, guardianship, and maintenance. So guardianship is where that right comes from, where they represent the children, because guardianship means I administer your estate, I administer your legal issues, and I administer anything to do with traveling overseas, whether there's legal requirements, your guardian can step in. But there are circumstances where, if it's in the interest of the child himself can apply to court with leave of the court to assist him, and also interested party can apply with leave of the court to assist him in legal matters.
How would a child apply to a court? I mean, how would that work, Advocate?
Well, a child would apply to a court with the assistance of an attorney, or with the assistance of a family advocate or social worker. They will assist the child to apply to court to assist them in anything that involves them. That will be anything that in the act, that means it's the care or their security or their maintenance, anything that affects their life. And they can approach any state organ, because the state organs have authority to act on behalf of the child. And we have to remember also that the court is the upper guardian of all minors.
Yeah.
They will step in any situation and every situation where they feel a child's interest is conflicted or is at risk. And if we look at the Children's Act of 2005 already, we've moved completely away from the old system where, if we look at the Child Care Act, that was completely focused on the parents' rights, what rights the parents have towards their children. That's why I think we called it access it was access and control. And that moved away. We're now focusing on children. What do children need? Children need four things in terms of the responsibilities and rights. It's, like I said, care, contact, guardianship, and maintenance. All those words are caring words. Like, do you care for the child? Do you want contact with your child? How can I be a good guardian of my child's rights? And maintenance is the financial situation. So our court completely shifted from parental rights to children's rights. And that's why it's easy for the kids now, or the children, to be protected in the Constitution, from child labor, from anything that's degrading to them. So that's Section 28 of the Constitution, too, cements the right of a child. It says it takes paramount. The interest of a child is paramount to anything. The wishes of the parents, the wishes of whoever wishes they need to consider. You need to look at a child and consider interest of the child. And the interest is determined by, it's not determined, but it's guided by Section 7 of the Children's Act. It sets it out beautifully. I think it lists about 15 things a court will consider for the interest of a child.
Yeah.
It will look at, I'm just going to mention about father then, and what's the relationship that the child has with the parent. What is the attitude of the parent or the person that has responsibility. And what is, if I take out that person, what effect will it have on the child? So everything is child-centered. And they look at the age of the child. Can the child make decisions at that age of maturity stage? And what are the circumstances it lives in? And can that parent or the person that has that right, do they have the emotional stability? Do they have the intellectual stability to give that child? So it's not just in the old days, do you have money? Yes. Can you do it? Yes or no. There are about 14, and those are just guidelines. So the bottom line here is, what is in the best interest of the child? The tools are there for the children to use or for practitioners to use. Mm. And you asked earlier, who can do that? Anyone with an interest can do it. I think Section 20 or 28 or the Children's Act sets out. It can be the co-parent or the parent that does it. It can be a person that has sufficient interest that can help the child, and that means a family member, any family member. It can even be a person that has an interest but is not a family member, but with leave of the court, like a teacher.
Right,
or
right.
Someone that actually cares for the child.
Right.
That says, I can see this happening in the child's life. The parents aren't doing anything. I will step in as a person of interest, as a teacher or someone that knows him, and I will help this child to achieve what I think he deserves in terms of his responsibilities. And a good thing for the last person that can step in is the state. The state can always appoint a family advocate, a social worker, any organization even, to act on behalf of the child. Right. So there are so many ways the child can be helped through the Children's Act.
Sure. So it appears that two things have happened in recent years with regards to laws that pertain to children. One, the centricity of the law has now shifted from the parent or the guardian to the child. It's about the issues that are for the best interest for the child, not the parent. That's the first thing.
Correct.
And I think that in itself is a place where we could just park and just really really talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
But secondly, it appears to me that the what is a derivative of that, what happens as a result of that, is that children are no longer objects or things to be pushed around and owned. They are understood to be animate human beings. With circumstance, with interpretations of life, and therefore they are not just items to be pushed around as though they are, you know, artifacts. There's a whole lot of human consideration for the child, which is very encouraging, because even the way that we talk about the child, it's almost as if we're not talking about a human being, we're talking about a thing, right? So it's very encouraging to hear that there's a centricity that's moved away from the parent to the child, and that the child is now seen to be a human being. But here's the question for you, Dr. Mayor. I mean, Advocate Mayor.
Yes.
You will know that over this COVID time, there has been a new regime where children between the ages of 12 to 17 may now go and get the jab without the consent of their parents, right?
Yes. Yes.
And I understand that in that particular case, it's because, you know, if a child believes that they have a chance at at survival in these pandemic times, then they ought not to have to get permission from their parent or consent from their parent. But then, are children as a principle, are children at the level of maturity and understanding that they can make decisions other than taking the vaccine using the same principle?
Well, that's a good question. I think if we look at again, I'm going to go back to the building blocks of best interest. So, if children can make decisions on like a medical procedure, which is not that invasive, of I have a right to life. I've got a right to decide over my own body. Remember, these are all the rights that come into play. I have a right to medical care. I have a right to survival. That's our constitutional rights that actually lean on that aspect of the children for the vaccination. The same principle you can apply in the family law aspect of what children can decide in a parental environment. However, I'm going to put that's where the maturity of the child comes in, the state of it of his or her development, and also the circumstances they are in. Because remember, with the vaccination, we're taking out one singular point, and we say, well, I can choose whether I get vaccinated or not. That is one aspect to health. But when the moment you go into parental rights responsibilities, where a child can start, well, if we can use that same argument, what he can choose or she can choose what is good for them, it changes completely in a sense that children not always know what's the best care for them,
yes,
what's the best maintenance they will need, what's the future going to be. So the moment a child says, and I'm going to use an example, I don't want to see that parent anymore. Of course, I don't like going to his house or her house. You can't just accept it because if a child tells you, I'm not going to brush my teeth, okay, you can say, okay, fine, that's your right. I don't want to go to school. You can say, or again, okay, I hear you, and that's your right to think that. But is that in your interest not to brush your teeth? Is that in your interest not to go to school? I understand you don't want to do that, and I hear you. But looking at what is in your interest, and that's how the court actually comes to looking at a family unit. Is it in the best interest of the child? And the best interest of the child, it's vast. You have to look from a bird's eye view, because we can see 4 years in advance or 2 years in advance. We hope so. And children don't have that concept of time. They don't comprehend time as we do. They don't see the bigger picture. So the children, their parental guidance is essential. And that's why the courts have also, they offer guardian on these decisions. But the interesting point is that the Children's Act also has Section 10. And that's where the emphasis comes in. Section 10 enforces child participation in anything. You cannot make a decision without the child participating in the process.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's in law you have to include, but that will determine on the child's level of maturity.
Yeah.
And it goes even further, Aubrey. It says that you, as the person dealing with this child's rights and life, you have to file a certificate in terms of regulation that says, I allow that the child participate in this procedure. This is what the child's concerns were. This is what the child said, and I don't want to do. I've considered his or her considerations or complaints or fears.
Yeah.
And this is what I think we should do, and these are the reasons I did not take these or her considerations into the application of what we're going to do with this, right? So it's very specific,
right?
Because that's why I say it's not just the child doesn't want to do it. You have to be, as a practitioner, file that certificate through a social worker or whoever. Say, we've done this. These are the reasons we excluded the child's consideration, and these are this is our conclusion of it.
Right.
So it's further than getting a jab.
So a number of questions come to mind, but so I do want to have the conversation about what are you know, what are full parental responsibilities and rights? Because I imagine that as we have this conversation and acknowledge the centricity of our laws for the child, I imagine that parents and perhaps even guardians who aren't parents have some sort of responsibility and rights. We'll talk a little bit about that. But I've just received a tweet from somebody called @retireddjcastro on Twitter. He says, Aubrey, I can tell you now that what appears in the book is completely different from reality. The child law system serves the best interests of the mothers and maternal relatives, reducing fathers to weekend visitors. Children are still treated as objects by the system, says this particular person. And it's not the first time, advocate, that I've had this sentiment expressed whenever we have this kind of conversation, that the centricity of the child's interests in real life, in the practical real life, is not about the child. It's usually about the mother. And I can almost understand why, because, you know, we've grown up understanding that mothers are the ones that are nurturing, especially for younger children. But that's no longer the case, I would argue. Fathers can nurture, fathers can do anything that mothers can do from the mothering and nurturing side of things. I'd like to hear your thoughts about that as you think about that, but we've got lots of calls. I'm hoping that you can jot that down and just keep it in mind. The whole question about what fathers experience, especially with issues such as custody, and I don't know whether that word custody is still the correct term to use these days.
No.
Yeah. So I'd love for you to think about that. I want to go straight to the lines. While you think about that, Advocate Sean Mayer. By the way, I'm in conversation with Advocate Sean Mayer. We're talking about minors, children, the law, parents, guardians, and how all of that works together in the interests of the child. Let's speak to Aubrey in Pretoria. Hi, Aubrey.
Hi, Aubrey.
Yeah,
how are you?
I'm good, man. Good to hear that Aubrey is a unisex name, yeah?
I'm telling you, it's a beautiful,
beautiful name. I know a couple of people that I really love who are named Aubrey. Aubrey, go ahead. What's on your mind?
All right. So I got married 20 years ago. I had two little girls.
Yeah.
I left my career. I moved after my husband, wherever he needed to go. And we ended up in a little town called Kokumas, which I did not enjoy at all.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, our relationship just went downhill. And I seeked help and I went to a clinic, not for alcohol abuse, but for mental, because of the way that he was emotionally abusing me, with the fact that I only had enough petrol in my vehicle to be able to fetch and take the kids to where they need to be. Fathers in custody. Custody is a horrible word. I think it's more like someone that
it's the objectification of children. Still, you know, it's we still objectify them in that in those kinds of terms. Yeah,
and they're not. They're little
human beings
sure. That can think for themselves.
Yeah.
My parents also got divorced, and I chose to live with my father because of the relationship that we had, and I've always wanted my little girls have that kind of relationship with their dad. And unfortunately, with a turn of events in my life, I did turn to alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
And I did it after my kids went to bed. But one night, on my birthday, I got intoxicated in front of my daughter.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't hurt her. I didn't do anything wrong. But that is being held against me in such a mean way. I have sought help from legal aid, and I am not getting anywhere. Tonight I was talking to my little girl, my youngest one. She needs her mommy.
Yeah.
She showed me with her little finger, and she said to me, this woman, take papa met my spandeer. Papa kom my stew, I eat, I slop, I stort, I slop.
Yeah.
And this is how take mama met my spandeer it.
Yeah. So just for those who might not understand Afrikaans, Aubrey.
Oh, sorry.
So her little girl made a gesture with a tiny little finger to explain how much time she, the little girl, believes her father spends with her, quality time. And the little girl said, you know, daddy just comes and he just showers, he eats, and then he sleeps. And basically signifying the very little quality time that the father spends with the child. Am I on the right track, Aubrey?
100%.
There you go.
100%.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the other part of the story is I always had a very good relationship with my mother-in-law.
Mm.
But she's 84 years old. She's a full-on type 2 diabetic. She's had a back operation. She's brought up her kids. She doesn't want to bring up kids, and that's what she's doing. Because
sure.
My ex-husband is working retail hours.
Yeah. And that's the reality for many go-gos, Aubrey, at the moment. And perhaps Advocate Sean Mayer will be able to shed some light on that. But what is the fundamental question with regards to your circumstances, Aubrey?
What can I do to motivate to get my little girls where they belong, with the emotional support, with the time they need? Mila has a learning problem. She needs a mommy.
Aubrey in Pretoria, much appreciated. Advocate Sean Mayer, first of all, it appears to me that Aubrey's situation challenges the idea that it is only men who tend to be at the receiving end of the unfriendliness of laws pertaining to children. But how do you answer a question?
Well, indeed, Aubrey. The answer lies in the question already. It's each and every single matter. I don't know whether there was a settlement agreement. I don't know if there's a parental plan. I don't know if a social worker was involved here. So just speaking, looking at it from a vacuum, what she's going through, remember, fathers and other mothers are going through as well. Depends on who your legal team was. It depends on who your judge was. It depends on who your family advocate was. What agreement did they come up with?
Mm.
So if your legal team just went the old route that said, I will give you every second weekend, I will give you this and every second holiday. That's the standard cookie cutter way of settling matters, but. There are more to that. You can draft a parental agreement, a parental plan, and that you can do through a social worker, a mediation and mediator, and that can be registered with a family advocate where you approach the attorney or you approach the family advocate and say, these are the requirements. Things have changed now. Remember, divorce is life is dynamic.
Yeah.
Situations change. Parents move to somewhere else. They get different jobs. So you have to move with the dynamics of your relationship with your kids and the relationship with work.
Yeah.
So you need to put your finger on the pulse and say, well, my circumstances have changed.
Mm.
I'm no longer here. I'm here. I earn a better salary. I'm involved in a stable relationship, for example. I want to see my kids more. I'm not happy with the way the agreement is done. I can sit down with a mediator and see if we can't draft a new parental agreement that gives me more access to my child or more contact to my child. That is easily done, but whether the other parent will agree with that, that's a different question.
Yeah, I can see that it's going to require a lot of maturity. I mean, it's going to need more maturity than the conversations about coalition governments.
The problem with parents are that, especially when they get divorced, we've got a no-fault system, which means the courts are not interested in who did what and why you divorced, who was the one that did not play according to the rules. They just say, do you want to get divorced? So none of the parents really get that chance where they feel vindicated and tell the court, you're the one that did it to me. This is what you destroyed our... So that's taken away. The courts are not interested. All they need to know, do you want to get divorced? Yes. So the only thing they can do, the parents, is use the children as pawns. And so we know that happens.
Mm.
But that's why you have to follow the Children's Act closely. Follow the Act, comply with the regulations, comply with the sections, do a proper parental agreement, do a proper settlement agreement, get someone involved, and a mediator that knows how, that's been doing this work for years, they know how things work, and redraft your parental agreement, register it at the family office, family advocate office, let them condone it, because circumstances change. And if you feel that your rights as a parent, and remember, it's not really your rights, your children's rights are not really addressed properly, there are ways of doing it, either through mediation and a parental agreement,
right,
or you can then approach court. If you really feel that strong, bring an application to court to change your settlement agreement or parental agreement.
Let's take some more calls. Sicelo is in Tsakane. Good evening to you, Sicelo.
Hey, Opry, how are you?
I'm well. I'm very well. Thank you, Sicelo. What's on your mind, sir?
So, Opry, I might have called a number of times before. I am denied access. It's been 3 years now. And every time an advocate or anybody in the law fraternity speaks of the best interest of the child, to me, it boggles me because I don't think there's that in reality. And my first question, or my main question to the advocate mayor, is what are measures out there available to measure the best interest of the child? And I'm saying this because, Aubrey, one, for instance, my child was relocated to a rural area from a better township with good schools and hospitals and everything that would make his life better, to where he needs the bus to travel to anywhere, you know, with no schools and clinics nearby. And the social workers, the minister's office, all told me the best interest of the child is what they looked at. And when I asked them, where is my child? The minister's office, the minister of social development, did not know where my child is. And yet they sitting with me in the meeting and they're telling me that they are protecting the best interest of the child. What is it that we use to measure the best interest of the child so that we can be able to be on the same level and engage on the way forward in terms of parental access and parental rights and the kids' rights? Because I still believe nothing has shifted. Like you said just now, it is all about the mother. It's all about where the mother wants to work and instead of about the child. And lastly, Opry, you know, when the whatever may be causing loss of access occurs, it takes far too long for the law or the social worker to intervene. In that time, the children will be influenced, alienated, and may not even be in a position to say what they want. What are the ways to ensure that, for instance, in my case, I was seeing my child each and every day before all of this happened? I would assume that the best interest of the child was on that day when I decided to go to the station report that things are not working out for me. They should have allowed me to see my child continuously until otherwise. You know, so what is really the best interest of the child, and what are the measures that are put in place to measure that?
Sicelo in Tsakane, much appreciated. Father in pain, it sounds to me, Advocate Sean Mayer. And he asks, I suppose, a very pertinent question. What are the objective measures for what is important or what is in the child's interest?
Thanks, Aubrey. Yeah, I think the moment we go to, well, objective measures are difficult when we deal with children because each and every single situation is different. So you have to look at the best interest of the child will determine on each and every single situation.
Mm.
And that's why I said in Section 7, those are guidelines. The best interest of the child will be what gives the child the most physical and emotional security, intellectual, emotional, and social and cultural development? Where will he or she get that? Does the child have any disabilities that need special care? Is there any chronic illness that the child will need special care from? Does the child need to be brought up in a stable family environment? What is the situation environmental-wise for the one parent towards the other one? Is there physical or psychological harm that can be caused in the situation where that child is brought up? Is there emotional harm where that child can be caused and where he is placed? Is there family violence in the child's area or from a family member close to one of the parents? So it's all those things that we look at, the security and the safety of the child. And also, a very important factor is the attitude of the parents towards that child. Has there been active attempts to be involved in the child's life? Was there WhatsApp? Did they go to the schools? Did they contact the mother or the father? The mother say, "This is what I want to do for the child." We had a matter, a full bench matter, where it was an interesting matter that dragged on for 14 years, and that's actually talking against the court system, but also for it. But the mother stole contact with this daughter. She was 3 years old.
Yeah,
for 14 years. The father only got the court order when the child turned 17, and the judge, it's a full bench decision that needs three judges, where the judges said it is shocking that the mother got away with it for 14 years. The court then ordered, even though the child said, "I'm happy where I am, I'm 17 years old, I don't know the person that's called my father. I want to finish my exams. I want to go on with my life." The court still said, "We understand that's what you want to do. And yeah, you are at the maturity to make that decision. However, we do believe because of your mother's influence, you were alienated. So we are making an order that you will have contact with your father."
Yeah.
It will be contact that is structured, and it's called and phased in contact. So you'll be 1 hour with him, then 2 hours.
Yeah.
And that, of course, will be subject to the report of a psychologist or a child psychologist that says, "These are the developments I see in the father and daughter relationship. These are the developments I see in the daughter's life." So it will be controlled. Those are the things that the courts look at. Because that father never, ever stopped trying to get contact. So you need to form a structure and a plan to see your child. You need to make an effort. All these things the courts will look at. If you give up or you just let it slide for a year or two, that's not going to count in the best interest of the child.
Yeah, yeah.
That's not going to count in your favor at all. Because the courts look at your attitude. It's a word that in the act, it looks at the attitude of the parent on how he's going to do it. So be consistent.
Yeah.
Be vigilant. Make sure you want to remain in contact. And then bring your application if you don't have the rights that you need to get. Bring your application. Let the social worker see the child, or let there be a consultation with you with a mediator. And then again, going back to that thing, then you can get access. But stick to your plan.
Yeah.
Get access to your child, not let that go.
So it's all about the consistency of the behavior of the parent seeking access to the child. And, of course, issues of attitude, as you've said there, Advocate Mayor. I wonder, though, whether, you know, we've spoken about the fact that the centricity of the law is now with the child. And in the past, it would have been with the parents. And in the past, it would have been leaning more to the mother because of the notions, particularly with younger children, of the ability of the mother to be nurturing, to be more caring, to be more present, and all of those wonderful things. Could it be, as you think about that answer while I take the next call, that the vestiges of that kind of mentality, that philosophy, are still very much operational in our legal system, especially as it pertains to child child legalities. I'd like for you to think about that, Advocate Mayor, as I take a call from Richard in Four Ways. Richard, thanks very much for holding. What's on your mind, sir?
Hi, Aubrey. It's your favorite Richard.
Yeah, how you doing, Richard?
Hey, listen, you know I've done a lot of things in my life.
Yeah.
And one of the things is that for the last 18 years, I've been an alienated parent.
Mm.
And my one twin daughter has not spoken to me for the last 4 years.
Mm.
Now, I could do a whole show on this, so I'm going to keep it brief. I can show you 3,000 parents in a group, mostly men, but I'd say about 20% women. And where there's this problem with a parent, like this 14-year case, well, I'm 18 years into it, and my kids are out of the family, or the Children's Act now, but I still have the effects, of this.
Yeah.
The courts are lazy. The courts are lax. Okay? And I've been through all the courts. I've probably had 50 court appearances to try and protect my children against a personality disorder. And that is what we face. And so you'll find there might be men who've gone up in a corporate situation and they have money and power and various things like that. And often it's because of a personality that achieves those results.
Mm.
And the opposite is you end up in a situation where the legal system, these words are beautiful words that Advocate Mayer has just sprouted forth. And I was interviewed by Carte Blanche in 2009 when the new act came out as a father representative.
Mm.
And I called this the family misery industry.
Mm.
And I said it's where the children pay the price and the lawyers make the money. Or turn that around. The lawyers make the money and the children pay the price. So the lawyers will tell you about all your rights and they'll pump you up and you'll believe that you've got a case and they fan the flames and they actually impoverish the whole family unit.
Richard,
I must credit Advocate Mayer. He talked about mediation, and that really is a major, major comment.
I hear you. Richard, thanks very much. Advocate Mayer, 30 seconds, my brother. I'm so sorry because this is such a big conversation. More calls still coming through, but we don't have much time. 30 seconds. A lot of pain, particularly from men in this particular situation. Yeah?
I think we can't take away from the fact that parents will be parents and humans will be humans.
Mm.
But there are tools. There are tools that you can use. There are tools that you can go for co-parenting guidance. You can go for co-parenting therapy. And the best way, I think, to solve it quickly, use the mediation options because it is also in the act. Use that to its ultimate.
Well, Advocate Sean Mayer, how do people follow you if they want to take these conversations offline? How do they have these discussions with you?
They can follow me at innovationlegal.co.za and also on my LinkedIn page at Advocate Sean Mayer, employed at Innovation Legal.
Much appreciated. Advocate Sean Mayer, innovative legal and child law expert.